Following message has been brought to you by Fairway Market. What's the buzz about honey? Well, those busy little bees are up to something, and it is delicious. The Fairway label honey is superb. Fairway only hires worker bees that are the best at what they do. This makes for a great tasting, high quality honey at an amazing value with the Fairway stamp of approval. And on top of being delicious, honey is a great substitute for other sweeteners and can even benefit your health. This includes better energy, respiratory improvements, and balanced blood sugar levels. It's a no-brainer. Get your Fairway honey today.
Welcome to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Terrickel, and Amanda Freitag is already giggling. Patty Jackson is also here.
Hi.
Today's show, just selfishly because I want to hang out with these lovely ladies.
See, that happens.
And, yeah, and chat a little bit about, you know, their illustrious careers, but also a little about the role of gender in the kitchen. You're both ladies, right?
Yes. Last time I checked.
Most of the time.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's sometimes a glaring thing walking into a kitchen and seeing the testosterone fly. But there's also, you know, a whole bunch of very renowned women, not just in New York, around the world, that cook and have had led the charge from, you know, Julia Child to Lydia Bastianich here in New York. But first, we're going to, you know, give them a little bit of your merits.
Yes.
Amanda grew up in New Jersey.
I did. I grew up in New Jersey. Don't hold it against me. Cedar Grove, New Jersey.
Yeah. You know, a lot of great fruits and vegetables come from New Jersey. I mean,
I know. I was trying to be supportive on Jersey the other day, talking about its mountains, its lakes, its valleys, its beaches, its farms. You know, Jersey's not a bad place at all. Although I didn't grow up around good food.
Yeah, yeah.
That wasn't. It was the impetus for my cooking was because I wanted good food.
Yeah.
So I, you know, fell in love with the restaurant business first.
Yeah.
And then luckily I had a skill for culinary. And went to CIA. Good old CIA.
The lovely CIA.
Yes, which I haven't been up there in years and years and years. Supposedly, it's just like Mecca now. It's like culinary Disney World.
Oh, yeah. I mean, anyone that's anybody that comes to New York now makes that trip.
Yeah.
And if you don't know what the CIA is, it's not the secret stuff because we're talking about it. The Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park.
Yep.
Patty, where did you grow up?
I grew up outside of Scranton, Pennsylvania.
Scranton. Wait, that's like from The Office? No.
Yeah. Yeah, Dunder Mifflin.
Yeah. Terrible.
It's really
reference.
Funny. Yeah. Actually, the Office does a great job of working in funny Scranton references.
Yeah.
If you're from there, it's very funny.
Yeah. And then you grew up, you know, eating your grandmother's cooking, having her cookies during Christmas.
Yeah, my grandmother loved to make certain kinds of cookies. I mean, I think I'm like Amanda. You know, I grew up, you know, people had gardens and things like that, but I didn't grow up really exposed to amazing food.
Yeah.
You know.
So it was like a feast or famine thing. You know, you were in this almost food desert trying to get out and find the more.
Well, I had a lot of fresh food growing up,
you know,
and probably a lot of seasonal food, but it wasn't necessarily on the cutting edge of exciting new culinary trends.
Yeah. And then went to...
If indeed there were any in the 70s.
Yeah. Fondue. Well, I mean...
Put some Spam and Miracle Whip on it. Delicious.
I mean, what were your typical family meals?
Oh, you want to take that one? My mom's probably listening.
Yeah, my mom too.
Yeah. No, this is a really big show amongst moms.
Yes.
Yeah.
Moms love this.
Well, you know, we kind of had a modern family. I was one of five kids, and we were kind of spread out, so... everybody was always kind of doing things. So there wasn't a lot of, I mean, I don't remember having a lot of sit-down dinners, you know, except on Sunday. More often than not, it was just kind of running around and kind of grabbing what was available.
Yeah.
You know, my parents both worked really hard. They, you know, one of us might cook, one of us might not cook.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a very similar situation. We were latchkey kids. My parents were working always, you know. You could pop in a TV dinner if you wanted that, you know.
Oh, TV
dinner. Pick out the one with the brownie or the one with, like, the, you know, apple pie thing.
Yeah. Oh, I do. I still love Steak-Ums.
I still love Steak-Ums.
Do they still make Steak-Ums?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Are they doing, like,
or they're the same ones.
Antibiotic-free,
I don't know.
Free-range Steak-Ums?
Like, if I do them, I shave my own steak, you know. But through college, I went through a lot of Steak-Ums.
Oh, yeah. Those were amazing. How 30 seconds to prepare.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, if that, yes.
You know, so I think we both kind of share that, like, food fascination. Like, when I started to learn about food, it was just fascinating to me. Like, what is that? What is this? How does it work? How do you cook it? You know, and just learning about the basics and then, you know, figuring you could just about do anything to food. And that, to me, was incredible. You know, this crazy imagination and super creative. And I just wanted to play with it.
Yeah. I mean, Patty, you went formally to cooking school in Baltimore.
I did. I went to pastry school when I went, which, you know, I went to pastry school before they invented the oven, kind of, because I'm so old. So, you know, at the time, there weren't, the CIA certainly didn't have a baking program. And it was tiny then. So, you know, all of a sudden the school in Baltimore decided that they were going to do a degree program in baking, which, you know, I learned a lot in baking school, you know, and it was a very unusual thing. You know, there weren't a lot of people who were doing it at the time, or going to school for it. Anyhow, obviously, there were probably a lot more bakeries and things at the time.
Yeah. But I mean, prior to having institutional education, what was your fascination with food? I mean, it wasn't TV dinners.
It was eating.
Yeah.
I loved to eat. I was a really fat kid.
No.
I should have brought photos today. It was, I mean, food was like the reward. Food was the thing. Food was everything to me. It was comforting. If I was happy, I would eat. If I was sad, I would just eat. After school, I would eat. Like, it was just food. It was all about food. And, you know, my grandparents were really good cooks. My grandmother used to make, you know, donuts that she would roll out onto her little kitchen table and cut out with like a Coke glass, and fry them. I mean, they were like lead bombs in your stomach once you ate them, but they were delicious. Yeah. My grandfather used to make, he was more on the Italian side, so he would make meatballs and stuff like that. But what I was fascinated by was, like, he would make the sauce for the pasta was brown. It was like gravy. It was like meat sauce.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
well, it wasn't, are you one of those people that call sauce gravy?
I don't. Yeah. I don't. It actually looked like a beef gravy that he would put. And I was like, that doesn't make any sense, you know. And then learning, you know.
Strangely, my grandmother's kind of looked like that, too. But
yeah. Not on purpose.
Not on purpose.
Yeah. You know, so then you go and you travel. I mean, I luckily got to travel around Italy. I'm sure Patty has too. And then you see the differences. You know, you're in the north and it sort of looks like that. And I was like, wow, maybe that's where my grandfather's family was from. Maybe that's why he made it that way. Or you go south and you see it differently. And so it's like all these things come rushing back in about food memories. And it's like, maybe that is connected.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I think for me, too, you know, I had a really similar kind of... It's so weird.
I know, right? We've never talked about this.
Yeah, we know each other pretty well, and we've never discussed any of this stuff. Yeah, you know, I don't know. I used to, like, love to go to the kosher deli, and I used to love to go to the... There was a, believe it or not, a Japanese steakhouse in Scranton. That was just fascinating. You know, and you know, I remember, like, trying Chinese recipes, and, you know, we didn't really have Chinese food in Clark Summit in, you know, the 70s. So I tried all this different food and I really liked it. I liked all the different flavors and the ideas that you could do. You know, you could mix this stuff together and make things. And then, you know, when I kind of get out in the world, it was like, wow, this is incredible. You know, like, people eat all kinds of different things.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we lived a pretty prescribed culinary life in my family. You know, my dad didn't eat a lot of things and there was what was easy to cook, you know, so, you know, there wasn't a lot of fresh fish, or there wasn't the idea. You know, the first time I saw an oyster or a soft shell crab, it was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like a bug. Was the pastry program that you went to all women?
No, no. There was a regular culinary program, and that was 50 people. And of the 50 people, two were women. And then there was a pastry program that I think there were 11 people, and maybe six were men, and five were women.
Oh. That's
yeah.
Because it also, it was kind of an industrial program at that time. You know, I shouldn't say industrial, but you know, we did croissants and Danish and things that you'd buy from a bakery. It wasn't just to make, you know, pretty little sugar sculptures.
Right. It wasn't patissier.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you made pretty little sugar sculptures.
It's interesting. Yes. I mean, the pre-concept, I think, is that women, you know, bake and do pastry. And
right.
There's been a major shift in the last decade of really renowned male pastry chefs and also really renowned female executive chefs.
Right.
But were a lot of those programs catered towards one gender?
I don't think when I went to school that they were, but I think that subsequently there were a lot of schools that kind of made their pastry a little more women friendly, so to speak. I mean, I think, but I also think that working in a kitchen, the sort of the structure of the kitchen, especially an older kitchen or the way things were done, made it a woman's... Oh, this is going to get me in trouble. But a lot of times women chose to do some of the jobs like pastry or garbage prep, those kind of things, because it gave them a more workable schedule to live their typical women lives, so to speak.
Yeah. No. I mean, I actually know a couple people. No, I know a couple people that worked as pastry chefs and as bakers, so they could be at home for children, etc. And you know, but I also know a couple guys who did similar things. One who was a bread baker, who did a 2:30 a.m. shift and got home at noon to take care of the kids during the day when the wife went away to work.
Yeah, and I love that.
Yeah.
So, I like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that's always, that's really attractive about the restaurant business or the food business is that there's always such flexibility, you know, in scheduling and kind of in job descriptions. I mean, everywhere you go, they're a little different. And I think that's a really great thing for women in general, you know, that many women have many different roles that they fill. And I think that's good for them.
Well, now it's exploded. Like when I came out of culinary school, you were a sous chef, a chef, or a certified master chef.
Yeah.
those were your options, you know, and you started as a prep and a line cook, and you did that for 50 years before you became any of those others. So there was no Food Network. There was no, there's a few food magazines, but nothing like, you know, the jobs that you can get as food stylists, recipe testers.
I mean,
none of that existed, you know, when I graduated culinary school. So the only option was to go work on the line. You know, that was it. There wasn't any other option. And pretty much it was working at night and on the weekends. I mean, I sort of weeded out. I did catering. I did small restaurants, big restaurants. And I realized I liked the sort of freestanding small restaurant situation. You know, I didn't love hotels. I didn't really love dragging stuff off premise to do catering. And once you find that out, then you sort of stay in that, you know, and it never had any of those other options, you know, like food styling or things that, I mean, our industry, our industry has exploded.
Yeah. The niche you know, has really become a niche.
It amazes me, you know, I mean, like just sitting back as this like sort of jaded, cynical, bitter observer, you know, it's like, you can do that? Like, people open that? And it's a success?
You know?
Versus, you know, 20 years ago, you know, the idea of, like Amanda said, you know, the idea of not being the chef de partie de pastry of whatever. You know, you didn't, not working through the stations and not, you know.
Yeah, the hierarchy's been eliminated. But at the same time, you talk about these, like, single subject things, be it jam, be it, you know, whatever, beekeeping. But Patty, you make everything. You try to make everything. Breadsticks, chocolate, you know.
I make everything.
Yeah.
But that's because I'm easily, I think I have like some sort of adult onset ADD. I'm so easily bored and easily overwhelmed sometimes. So sometimes it's just nice to go and, you know, I mean, I miss touching bread every day. That's something from the pastry thing that, you know, you never lose that.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, I'll go through a whole week where I just want to temper chocolate. And then I'll go through a whole week where, you know, we could make a better muffin.
Yeah. And you cure some of your own meats in-house.
My own meats. We make all of our own sausage. We make all of our ice creams and all that stuff. I mean, you know.
So specification is starting
to... My staff hates me.
Yeah.
Just like, we need sausage. And then my sous chef yesterday was like, we need sausage again. He looked at me with like such hatred.
Yeah.
Like, I hate you. Why?
It's like, give me $20. I'll walk around the corner. I'll get us some sausage.
I'm going to go buy sausage. Yeah. I don't want him to know that he could.
Yeah.
You know, it's like just keep him in the dark in the basement. Like, just keep making yeah. the sausage.
Do you feel like your upbringing in the kitchen was kind of like that, too? I mean, you cooked in D.C. for a whole bunch of years.
Yeah.
You came to New York.
I've been in New York pretty much
worked
my
with
whole,
Jean-Georges.
Yeah, yeah. My whole career.
But was it kind of that regimen thing where it's like, we make everything, we do all this?
Yeah, always. I mean, I worked at Verbena for 6 years with Diane Forley, and that was like an amazing experience because it was sort of this petri dish of loveliness, of making everything, being right next to the Union Square Green Market, having yeah. just this wonderful, it was almost like being in a culinary school, yeah. except a lot less people in the kitchen, you know. We made all our own bread, all our own ice cream, everything. I mean, to me at the time, like, that was incredibly inspiring, you know. Like, we didn't even buy bread. Maybe every once in a while at brunch we'd buy one bread item just to make it a little easier yeah. for ourselves. Yes. You know, but yeah. that also felt weird, you know. What are we doing? You know, we would make grissini, you know, and that was tedious, and you know, but it showed. I mean, that was a gem of a restaurant, and it was details. It was details, details, details. And I feel like if you touch everything, if you make everything, there's a huge difference. You really feel it.
That's in a way that's a one, like a woman chef thing.
Yeah,
I agree. Very much so. I think that like men are happy to seek out something that they love a lot. You know, that, oh my God, I had this thing and it's so great and we're going to sell it in our restaurant. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But I think most of the women I know take a lot of pride in doing, you know, the minutiae.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the pastry thing, you know, that the pastry chef always wants some vision of themselves to be there. And I think that women do the same thing.
Cool. Well, we're going to take a quick break and come back to that point of, you know, seeking and making. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. We'll be right back.
Radio Network. Join Linda Palacio for A Taste of the Past every Thursday at 12 p.m. as she indulges her curiosities about food, cooking, drinking, and dining of the past by taking a journey through culinary history. Linda interviews authors, scholars, friends, and chroniclers to learn about what was eaten, where, and how, from as long ago as ancient Mesopotamia and Rome, right up to the grazing tables and deli counters of today. The show underscores food as a lively link between present and past cultures. Again, that's Thursday at 12 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. I've almost got too many names sometimes. I get out of breath, can't say that all at once. With Amanda, is it Freitag or Freitag?
It's Freitag.
Freitag, yep. Friday in German.
Friday in German.
Yeah.
Yep. So.
I missed your first name while typing it in Google to try to find your website. I'm like, oh, Friday in German.
Friday in German.
But I'm sure you knew that.
I love that day. It's
Patty Jackson.
That's a hard one to say.
Well, you know, in Europe, though, I'll always go to like a hotel and I'll walk up and I'll say, I have a reservation for Jackson, and they can never find my reservation.
Really?
Yeah.
Tons of Jacksons?
The spelling doesn't print, you know, it's like Jackson or something, you know. Or, you know, one time I was sent to Italy to get jackets embroidered, and they couldn't do it because they didn't have a pattern for the J.
Were they Greek? Were they just doing like you know, V's instead of U's?
Like I-A-C-H.
Yeah.
S-O-N-N-E.
See, whereas mine translates to every language, it's and rhymes with my last name too. It's Michael Turkel, and then it changes into Miguel Turkel, Michelle Turkel, Michael Turkel.
So nice,
you
though,
just do a sing-songy thing, and everyone kind of gets it.
I like that.
But enough about me. Seeking versus making, I think, is a really interesting crux. You know, Patty was kind of saying that she sees more so in men go and look for these, you know, ingredients or look for these things to bring back into the kitchen.
Yeah, I'm going to get in trouble with men for
saying that. Yeah. Screw men. I'm saying that on
wow.
air.
Yeah. Wow.
Trying to start a hot debate. Maybe I'll have a man show next.
Man show.
Well, I mean, I think it's when I started in pastry, I worked for a very nice French chef. But, you know, he was always, and I'm not sure if, I guess it was his Frenchness in a way, he was always looking for perfection. So everything got reduced to a very specific formula of not necessarily a fresh thing, right? Maybe it was a frozen puree or a jarred puree or a kind of a specific gelatin that set a specific way. And that was great. But then when I went to work for Italians, where God knows there are no rules,
yeah.
All of a sudden, it was a different sort of a calculus, right? So it was always an experimentation, you know, yeah. Like, oh my God, we have a fresh watermelon. I'll try to do something with it.
Well, when you were hired by Pino, how do you say his last name?
Luongo.
Luongo for El Madre. Did you get...
Actually, I was hired for Mad 61.
Mad 61. Did you get carte blanche, say, do whatever you want to do? Or he's like, I got all this great stuff.
Not originally.
Yeah.
Not originally. I came to Pino because I'd worked with some of his other chefs in D.C. Some people who worked for him had worked with me in D.C. And so when I came to him, they were opening Mad 61, which was a huge complex in Barney's. And so I was sort of a known quantity, but I wasn't a New York known quantity. So there were different people. There were some terrific people I worked with there. Stacey Pierce and Paula Oland were, you know, Stacey did the pastry for the restaurant and Paula did the bread. I did the other fill-in things, and yes, I guess I had carte blanche in that, you know, but then as they went on to do their other things, then I took over that, and I guess I had carte blanche with everything else.
Because I've always...
But I mean, I was the pastry chef, so I only had carte blanche as far as the chef saying,
But, I mean, do you feel like women in seeking try to collect other women or try to collect other people, mentors, and you know, sometimes men look towards this restaurant and with an associated name, mm-hmm. but they look for a more mentoring place than they do for I can say I worked here.
Yeah, I mean, we came to find that at Verbena a lot because it was a female chef owner, and then you know, when I was a sous chef and chef de cuisine, we had a lot of women applicants. I didn't know why, you know, I more feel like I have an insight on it now, but even then it was just perplexing to me. And, you know, I didn't necessarily love that because women who are maybe not that skilled in the kitchen and were not really good cooks were coming to apply and expecting to be hired just because we were women running this business. And it was, you have to be a good cook.
Yeah.
You just because you're a woman doesn't mean you're going to get the job. And honestly, having a kitchen full of women is not a great idea. Or having a kitchen full of men is probably not a great idea. I mean, there has to be some balance. You know, I don't personally like it any one way. You know, you have to have a balance of men and women and, you know, different ethnicities and different skill levels. And I mean, I think every cook on the team brings something else to the party. So, your quiet guy, you have your gregarious guy, you have your guy that's, you know, going to bring everybody together. Like, I think it's just, I found that to be almost annoying in a way that women were mostly our applicants. I mean, when we would get a guy applying for a line cook job, we would be fascinated. Like, how did you hear about us? Yeah. Why do you really want to work here? Yeah. You know? Yeah. And it was
awesome. It like, my girlfriend loves your restaurant?
Yeah. He found out through a woman somehow. Yeah. You know, but it was also a very different kind of an environment, whether it be female run or male run or whatever. It was a mature kitchen. It was mature. We were focused on the food. We weren't screaming, yelling, throwing things at each other. It was very, very much about the food and the love of what we were doing. So there was also a different vibe of that. And anybody particularly probably young men who were coming in and thought they wanted to work there and weren't getting sort of yelled at or weren't getting the discipline that they thought they should be getting at the time, sort of weeded themselves out.
Really?
You know, they loved the food, they loved the place, but then they would come and they would work there and they just didn't understand the vibe. Yeah. It didn't make sense to them. Why aren't you yelling? Why are we all getting along kind of thing? Like, you know, and they
I
would
think
almost,
that's a really great point though.
Yeah. They would almost act out to try and create something because it didn't, they're fish out of water kind of a thing. You know, it's weird.
Well, it's like me being like, I guess I'm not middle-aged, but you know, a 30 somethings white male from Westchester. It's like, I don't really have a point of view necessarily, and they want to be able to have something to say, like, oh, the kitchen I work in is so crazy because, or have some kind of, you know, a fodder for a conversation or for stories down the road. But you know, I guess that's what they've always heard and that's what they always assumed, you know, was happening.
It was very interesting. I mean, I worked there for 6 years and then I moved on to this other job, and I was at this kitchen and it was, you know, it was an opening sort of a thing. It took a while to get it open, train the crew, whatever. The first night, the chef started screaming. And I was completely startled because I had been in this lovely environment for 6 years. And I thought, hasn't everybody evolved? You know, I thought everybody out in the world evolved. And everybody was that way. And I was like, okay, this still goes on. This is just, I'm going to have to. At that point, and I'm still not there yet. But at that moment, I was like, I can't wait to have my own so I can create that environment again. You know, like, I've been able to do it where I've led kitchens, but I still haven't 100% been able to get back to that, you know, productive yet amazing place to work in, yet, you know, mature.
Yeah. I mean, what other mentors did you have that had that same kind of vibe, the both of you? I mean, because you've worked with wonderful people, you know, in New York, from, you know, Tom Valenti and Cesare and...
Yeah. I think particularly I worked with Marcia Pollini, who is a really amazing Italian woman. And she was a collaborator. She, you know, she really liked to talk through things. And I thought that was like such a good quality. And I find that that's something I really like. I really like to, you know, have half of an idea and talk to my cooks and say, what do you think? Or what would you like? And I find that that's always something like that's kind of about half of the cooks in the universe, male or female, are really uncomfortable with that.
Yeah.
You know, you know, why are you asking me? Like, it's not a task. I like to bounce things around, you know? I think that I found that those kind of chefs were a lot of fun versus, you know, I have a vision and it's this and, you know, you need to execute it. But then they could never really produce their own vision either, you know.
Well, so it was like the antithesis of a cooking school, you know, because you were given measurements and, you know, this program to work through, but you were never say go.
Right. And you were told not to think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't think, you know, chef, I think, no. Just do.
Actually, I told somebody to stop thinking today.
There you go. See, it's still alive today.
Sometimes though, I think that's a good, that really is good advice though. Sometimes, you know, just stop thinking about it. Just do it. You know, when people ask me for like bread making advice, it's like, don't think. What's the worst thing that's going to happen?
No,
don't over.
Well, that's scary. I think bread making, for me, bread making and pastry are scary because for me, I'm sort of that stir it, taste it, fix it, work with it chef. You know, pastry, it was never my forte. I can do it, but it's not my forte. It's like you mix it. Once it goes in the oven, that's it. You can't handle it again and then fix it somehow, you know, like
you have a similar set of fixes available to you as a pastry chef. But then you just have to accept that things aren't always going to be perfect, which pretty much would kill any pastry chef,
right?
You know? So that there is that idea, but you know, I don't know why people are so afraid of those things. It's funny that you say that as a woman though, because usually that's a male thing, like pastry, I can't touch it.
No, I mean, I don't mind doing some basic stuff. So there's moments where I've worked in very small restaurants where I've done the pastry menu as well, and basics. My dad used to love pastry, and I would call him in the middle of a crazy morning where I'm trying to do everything and make something, and I'm like, what's a conversion on, you know, teaspoons to tablespoons on this? You know, it's like I needed that brain, that, you know, brain that was very scientific because I just wanted to get done. You know, when you want to just get it done, pastry's not the place you should be in. You know, you sort of, it has to, timing, everything has to be measured perfectly. I mean, I'm the girl who doubles a recipe and then doesn't double one of the ingredients. Or, you know, I'm that person because I'm trying to fly through it.
You just need to do it more.
Yeah. No, it's funny. I'm seeing less and less. I didn't want to, but I kind of call this, you know, like the female chef show, gender wars. But not that there are wars, but the more and more I hear people talk about the role of gender in a kitchen, the less and less I think it is about gender. But I think it's about not even upbringing, but the institutions and the way people learn and the way people then cook. So like, there is the... I think I have to measure, I think I have to be precise, and then I think I can do everything on the fly with that kind of knowledge. And I think it's really more those two parties, those two sides of the brain, than it is X versus Y chromosome.
Yeah, than it is male and female. I agree. I think it's so hard for me because now I'm sometimes in that mentor role.
Yeah.
And, you know, females will come to me and ask me a lot of questions, and I don't want to get frustrated, but sometimes it's hard because I don't want to be categorized either. You know, I want to say, just think of yourself as a chef, you know, because when, I'm sure Patty has this too, when you're working in the kitchen, when you're overwhelmed, when you have so much to do, you're not running around saying, I'm a female, I'm a female, I'm a female. You know, you're going to cook on the line, you're like, I'm a female chef right now. You're not thinking that, you know? You're like, I got to get this shit done, you know? Like, I'm busy and I got to get it done. Like, you don't even think when you're doing that.
Yeah.
Until it's until somebody really points it out to you.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, you know who you are in your body, but until somebody really points it out, like, you're a great female chef. And like, oh, does that take something away from the fact, like...
Or is it an enhancement?
Or is it an enhancement? Yeah. You know, it's like, wow, look, you ran that marathon with one leg. Good job. You know, like, it's sort of...
Yeah, no, I always feel kind of uncomfortable when people are... Which is funny, because I'm here discussing it right now. But when people are like, you know, so what is it like being a female in a kitchen? It's like... It's the same thing as it is being a female everywhere else, you know? I mean,
I thought you were going to say constant hot flashes.
Yeah, right. But that's what it feels like in a kitchen.
Yeah.
We don't joke about that kind of stuff. You know, but I mean, sure, I spent a lot of my life being the only girl in the kitchen
or
being surrounded by guys in the kitchen. So I never saw myself as different than anybody else, you know? I don't see myself as having a different role. I don't see myself as... you know, not being able to pick things up or put things down or, you know, except now I'm old. So, you know, people just look at me like, how can you do that when you're so old?
No,
they do. Yeah.
I think like what we were talking about though, before the show started, I think it's a little now at our levels, you know, what I'm more thinking about is business. And, you know, what I was telling you before the show started is like, I got a business plan and it's done. And now all I need is the investors. And I think for me, that's a skill that doesn't always get passed along to women. You know, the guys are kind of sort of negotiating and they've got the business plans and blah, 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 blah. You know, and the girls are never really in on that. Or the girls are not going to business school or whatever it is. There's something left out. Men don't want to negotiate with women for some reason, or I don't know what it is. I'm still trying to learn myself, like we were saying, but I think people are less apt to invest in a woman business owner, and I don't know why. It's a generalization, but I see how it's more difficult for women to get supported and money and investors than it is for men, and I'm still trying to learn the phenomena on that one, you know, and I don't know. I need to find out how to make it work for myself. Otherwise, I'll never have what I want to have. But
I'd agree with you. But I think that whole idea kind of spreads itself to a kind of a wider plane. Mm-hmm. I can't negotiate with my plumber. I could tell, you know, the water could be. You know, geysering up from the floor, and I could say there's a problem, and he would say no. No, there's nothing wrong there. You know? What? You know, one time we had a problem with one of our toilets, and he was like, you have to flush it harder.
That's a great solution.
That's a great solution. And by the way, I'm the only person who has this problem, and that's why I called you hysterical.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I think a lot of times, you know, whether it's that, you know, guys have a guy network kind of a feeling, and that's, you know, or whether it's that, you know, they're just not accustomed to dealing with women in sort of that kind of, my kind of role. I'm not sure what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I could tell you right now, having tasted both of your food, one, it's funny because, Patty, I almost feel like you're in a Nona-style atmosphere and people expect a grandmother to be cooking this, but...
It's so funny, but, you know, I'll put something new on the menu that I think is, like, really modern and groundbreaking, and Nona will be sitting in the front making her pasta.
Yeah.
And I'll be standing right next to her, and people will walk out and they'll say, great food, Mama.
Yeah.
You know, and Dora just sits there and goes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Grazie.
Yeah. So. But I bet you they assume, too, that there's a backbone of... You know, some guy down in the kitchen breaking down the meat, making the this, the making the that. But there's this face of Nona up front.
Yeah, well, sometimes I make her break down the meat.
Yeah.
Crack that way.
Yeah. But, I mean, and Amanda, I don't think I could have told anyone that it was a female chef when eating your food.
Right.
You know, and I see that with Patty's too, having been to Etruly a couple times through its iteration of chefs. You know, obviously the food has changed and you are my favorite iteration. Yes.
Aw, thanks, Michael.
But I mean, I never walk into a restaurant and be like, ooh, can I see a menu? No. Or like, can I see the gender of your chef?
Right.
Like, but I think that's always really fascinating too, though, when you always see these things when, you know, the roundup of women chefs and it's like, well, you can tell that, you know, you can tell Anita Lowe's a woman because her name is Anita Lowe. I mean, come on, you know? I don't think that she cooks in a way that necessarily indicates she's a woman.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I don't think that Rebecca cooks... Rebecca Charles cooks in a way that indicates that she's a woman.
Yeah.
You know? I don't think that... You know, I could name like 30,000 women, I guess. But, you know, I don't really always understand, you know, why it's... so significant.
Yeah.
I think it's groundbreaking that there are so many women in the field now, though.
Yeah.
I do think we have to give ourselves some props there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to segue onto that, I think we should really give props to a project you're working on. What Happens When.
Yes. What Happens When Women Take Over.
Yeah, yeah. Monday nights.
Monday nights at What Happens When, which is a temporary restaurant in Soho. It's a woman chef, woman pastry chef, and a female sommelier. And it's been an incredible experience. 20% of the night's profits go to charity. And it's been really fun for me because I do the kickoff dinner and then I'm the ambassador and I work with each woman who comes in. So I mean, I would have had to probably work for 7 years to have done these 7 dinners that I did over the last 7 weeks and worked with these women, you know. So it's a great night and we all have a blast and it's all for a good cause.
Cool. Who do you have coming up?
Patty Jackson.
Strangely.
Couldn't have planned this better.
Patty Jackson's coming up, you know.
So
but
excited.
This upcoming Monday.
Yeah. So this is pretty cool.
And are there tickets still available?
Well, you just make a reservation online on their reservation system. And, it's just what happened was John Fraser came to me and said, I have this idea, which... I just thought he was out of his mind because he has Dovetail Uptown.
Yeah.
He was running What Happens When Tuesday through Sunday, and it was closed on Mondays. And he said, I want to open on Mondays with this female chef thing. You know, if I was running 2 restaurants and I had Monday off, I'd be on my couch, but that's just me. And he asked me to collaborate. And that alone, just that action on his part, was amazing. It's very rare that I'll have another male chef come to me and say, I want to do this thing with females in the industry. You know, so I thought that was pretty amazing on his part, just to say, this is something I want to do. Monday nights are empty right now. Let's do this thing. So, and my other favorite part was we were thinking, oh, we have to look at the James Beard calendar. We're going to have to look at the Macy's DeGustibus and see when women chefs are in town, like try and fill up our calendar. We basically did it locally.
Yeah.
You know, through October. We basically did it with women who are local, maybe D.C. or Philly, but... there's tons of women chefs out there, you know, doing it every day. So it was pretty cool.
And to see some of the best, check out What Happens When on Mondays. Ladies, thank you.
Thank you.
And if there are any potential investors, male or female, call the both of them.
Please.
Both. Separately or together. You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.com. Your host, Michael Harlan Turkell. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a public service announcement from Just Food. Help bring live chickens into food challenge communities through your donations to the Just Food City Chicken Project 2011. The City Chicken Project would not be possible without the volunteer hours, donations large and small, and the vibrant energy and ideas of the communities we work with. Just Food is a nonprofit organization that connects New York City communities and local and urban farmers with the resources and support they need to make fresh, locally grown food accessible to all. To donate, search on Kickstarter.com for Just Food and find their City Chicken Project. For more information on Just Food, visit justfood.org or call 212-645-9880. That's 212-645-9880. Let's keep making New York City a better place to live and eat. The following is a message from Zingerman's. From June 30th to July 3rd, 2011, come hang out at Camp Bacon, a four-day festival hosted by Zingerman's. The main event is an all-day affair at Zingerman's Roadhouse featuring plenty of bacon, bacon learning, and such luminaries as Alan Benton, John T. Edge, Molly Stevens, and more. The event will be taking place in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Proceeds from this event benefit Southern Foodways Alliance. Also, on Friday, July 1st, there'll be a special benefit performance featuring Andre Williams and the Gold Stars and special guest John Langford and Skull Orchard. Visit www.zingermanscampbacon.com for more information and for tickets. Once again, that's www.zingermanscampbacon.com.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. This week in MeetingPlace.com, a report prepared by 10 international agencies for next week's Group of 20 conference in Paris is recommending that major governments drop policies supporting biofuels because of the effect they have on global food prices. The report was generated by experts from groups such as the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, and the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. It notes that abrupt changes in the price of oil can lead to crops diverted to produce biofuels, which in turn increases food price volatility. It recommended that government subsidies that support biofuel development be abandoned, a topic that U.S. Agriculture Secretary Thomas Vilsack is expected to address on some level when he meets with the G20 on June 23rd. In an address yesterday before the National Press Club, Vilsack said he believes that corn-based ethanol doesn't deserve the bad reputation it received in recent years with regard to rising food prices, saying that biofuels played a minor role in food price increases in 2008. We diverted 40% of our national corn crop into the ethanol program this past year. It has had an indisputable effect on farmers who have seen their corn prices rise for feed for their cattle and pork and chickens, something like 50 to 60% over the last year. This, in turn, has had a major impact on the consumer and grocery stores. This has been Behind the Scenes News with Katie Kiefer.
Aaron Fitzpatrick and Brian DeMarco host Unfiltered, Heritage Radio Network's very own wine program. Here's a small clip.
I will say that I tasted a lot of wines, and I went to Bollinger. Mm. And it was the special cuvée, which is, and I'll explain the difference between that and Roeder in a minute, but the special cuvée was the most three-dimensional wine that I'd had in my mouth up until that point, and it was actually pretty much one of the only ones of the day. Really spectacular, and it's made, I'll just say, in a different style from Roederer, because it is a certain portion of the blend every year, and their style is aged in barrels, and it gives it more of a toasty, fuller style. And it's really, you know, it's a big champagne.
It's a masculine champagne.
It is. I tried to stay away from that, but it's true. I mean, James Bond, the whole thing. Yeah. But it's a big wine. It's a great food wine. But then,
want to hear more? We'll tune in every Tuesday at 4 p.m. live to Unfiltered, or check out the old episodes in our archives. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. Thanks for listening.